So before we get started this evening, I've got a few announcements for PsyChi members. For current and our newly inducted members, the PsyChi's annual or monthly newsletter, The Eye on PsyChi, is available at PsyChi.org, and we've always got copies of that at the psychology department as well, if you're interested in taking a look. The newsletter always includes tips for getting into graduate school, spotlight on careers in psychology, and information about grants for student research. So we encourage you to take advantage of that resource. I also want to take a moment to talk a little bit about the PsyChi Journal of Psychological Research. This is a peer-reviewed journal designed for undergrad, graduate, and faculty PsyChi members. And I always encourage, especially our senior thesis students, as they finish directed research, to talk with their thesis advisors about the possibility of submitting their theses for publication. It's a really great opportunity to sort of get your feet wet in the peer-reviewed journal world and in a very friendly and welcoming environment for student researchers. Also, as a member of PsyChi, we invite you to participate in local, regional, national, and international opportunities to meet other PsyChi members. Most of these activities are held in conjunction with sort of the major conferences that happen in our major professional organizations. So in April, in Pasadena, there will be the Western Psychological Association meeting, and there will be a PsyChi event and sort of opportunity for networking there. And also in San Francisco next year, when Western Psychological Association celebrates 100 years, there will be more PsyChi opportunities there as well. If you're a member of the APA, in August, in Chicago this year, the APA will be holding their annual conference, and that would be an opportunity to meet other PsyChi members from around the nation. If you'd like to get involved locally, serving as a mentor to another student is always a terrific way to do that. You could speak at a career or graduate school panel here on campus, or get involved in planning our PsyChi events. And if you're interested in doing that, I'm the chapter advisor here at Dominican now and would be happy to talk with you more about those opportunities. So please feel free to email me or reach out to the department, and I can help put you in touch with opportunities to get involved with PsyChi here at Dominican. I like to take a moment to remind everyone, as we've got a lot of graduating seniors in the room as well, that after you graduate, we'd really like to continue to invite you to be a part of the PsyChi community. And the best way we can do that is if you keep us in touch with your most up-to-date email. So as you no longer have access to your Dominican email, or you want to let us know where you head, the psychology department always appreciates knowing where our PsyChi members go, so we can invite you to events like this one. So you can either email me or our administrative coordinator, Aria Ducci, and let her know. That brings me to the big thank you for the evening. Of course, I want to thank the entire psychology department. We could not do this without a group effort, but I especially want to thank Aria Ducci. I cannot even spot her in the audience right now. Oh, she's working, as usual, but I hope that we can have a moment to have a round of applause for Ari, because she is truly the person that makes this event happen. Everything from culling the lists of who we invite to PsyChi every year to determine eligibility, to putting together the invitations and the emails and making sure there's wine. Ari is the person who does this. So thank you for joining me in thanking her. As we begin our induction ceremony this evening, I want to welcome our new inductees to this organization. PsyChi is an international organization charged to advance the science of psychology and secondarily to encourage, stimulate, and maintain the scholarship of individual members in all academic fields, but particularly in psychology. The name PsyChi represents two Greek words, psyche and kairos. Psyche represents the mind and reflects the scholarship and enrichment of our minds. Therefore, membership in this organization is based on outstanding scholarship, bearing in mind that scholarship means more than good grades, but also striving for real mastery of content and doing work with integrity. Kairos, meaning hands, represents our fellowship in research. Psychological inquiry requires observation, logical thinking, and critical yet tolerant open-mindedness, and can only move forward in the context of a community of scholars. PsyChi's motto, Psyche Kairos, describes our mission of cooperation in the investigation and cultivation of the mind. So congratulations to all of you who have just been accepted into membership. Tonight, to those of you who will be inducted, you'll receive a special medal. You're entitled to wear this medal at graduation, and we encourage you to wear this at commencement with your regalia. So if you could please come forward and receive your certificate and medal as I read your name. Madeline Christensen. Lauren Farrell. Heidi Francis. Camille Hildebrand. Kelly Huang. Haley Hunter. Christine Angela Manalong. Catherine Metcalf. Mia Nguyen. Kaylee Nelson. Emily Pareto. Chriselle Ramos. Katya Rice. Rhoda Robertson. Kylie Villanueva. Marielle Villanueva. And Emily Nguyen. Congratulations to all of our inductees, and thank you so much to those of you that could join us tonight. When Dr. Gail Matthews founded Dominican's chapter of Psi Chi in 1980, she decided to continue a tradition from her undergraduate chapter of Psi Chi, honoring a senior Psi Chi member with an award for service commemorated with a signed book. Carrying on this tradition, our department presents our annual Psi Chi Service Award alongside a book signed by its author or our evening celebrated speaker from the night's ceremonies. The award is presented to a senior Psi Chi member who's contributed the most in the way of service to the psychology department, the community, or to the field of psychology. Tonight, we will present the book, The Imposter Phenomenon, suggested and signed by our speaker and chapter founder, Dr. Gail Matthews. This year's winner is a student who's been an active member of the psychology department and engaged both in the campus and local community during her time at Dominican. As a student ambassador, she's one of the first faces that our prospective students get to know. You've probably seen her leading tours or helping orchestrate events for incoming students, and I know I count on her being there at events as my plant in the audience to talk up the psychology department. Within the psych department, she's served as a peer advisor, patiently helping her peers select their courses for the future and supporting them in decision making. She's the type of student that the whole department agrees we can always count on to show up and lend a hand when anyone needs it. Personally, I appreciate that she's around with a calm smile and a kind word, even on the most chaotic of days. For the past 4 years, she's worked as a research assistant for both Afshin and I, dedicating many hours to the success of our research projects and presenting posters at 2 scholarly conferences. At the Western Psychological Association conference this April, she's presenting again, this time the results of her senior thesis, in which she studied the influence of acculturative stress and discrimination on student mental health and well-being. Beyond the boundaries of our campus, she's put her psychology training to use in the community as a volunteer for a number of local organizations, including St. Vincent School for Boys and Young Moms Marin. I know I speak for the whole department when I say that we'll miss her when she graduates this May, but I'm excited to watch her begin the next chapter of her journey. Regardless of where life takes her next, I know that she'll continue to do good work and make life better for the people around her. On behalf of the entire psychology department, we're proud to honor Danielle Davis as our 2019 PsyChi Book Award recipient. Our honored speaker this evening likely needs no introduction. Dr. Gail Matthews joined the Dominican University of California Psychology Department in 1976 and chaired the department from 1977 until 1999. Over her years at Dominican, she's expanded the positive reputation of the department, faculty, and students. At the same time, she maintained a private practice in clinical psychology and became involved in executive and life coaching. Her major research areas include the just world hypothesis, the imposter phenomenon, and strategies to enhance goal achievement. Tonight, Dr. Leanne Bartolini will be interviewing Dr. Matthews about her life and career in psychology spanning more than 40 years as an active faculty member, researcher, and clinician.
Gail's suffering from the imposter phenomenon right now. Gail was born in the small town of Highland Springs, Virginia. I only learned today that it was called Highland Springs because the entire 40 plus years I've known Gail, she pronounces it Holland Springs. And then I Googled it and learned that it's actually Highland Springs. Every once in a while, Gail still has that Virginia accent. She attended college at West Hampton, received her PhD in social clinical psychology at the University of Kentucky in 1968, which was a rare thing for women to do in the 60s. After various positions back east, she made her way to California in 1976 with her then husband Larry and her daughter Holly. And she began teaching here, as you just heard, in the fall of 76. She began that PsyChi chapter. She and I still fight about whether or not it was 1979 or 1980. And we're never going to resolve that one. And she led this chapter for almost 40 years. I met Gail during my first semester as a transfer student at Dominican. She became a mentor, encouraging me, and as you heard earlier tonight, countless others to go on and receive their doctorates or master's degrees in psychology. Little did I know then, as a young girl, really, I wasn't even yet 20 when I met Gail, that she would become a lifetime colleague and friend. And you're going to learn a lot more about Gail tonight as I attempt to interview her, and I say attempt because I know she's going to lead us down a few circuitous paths, and she's going to fill us with her infectious and famous laugh as we talk about her life and her work in psychology here at Dominican and in the field at large. So please join me in welcoming the unforgettable Dr. Gail Matthews. And Gail's going to take the blue chair here. And I'm going to turn on the little recording machine. We're ready.
Okay, good.
All we need is the box of Kleenex. Where's that? So can you tell us a little bit about your family of origin and what influenced your decision to enter psychology from that background?
Well, I think I have to start with my dad. He was English and German. He was a twin, a fraternal twin. He was the black sheep in the family because he was a cut-up. He was always laughing, and he would be sent from the dinner table because he was laughing and telling jokes. And that later became true in my own family because when I would, my mother didn't want laughing at the table. And so I would be laughing and she'd correct me and my dad would, of course, have to crack me up again. So it was a pattern that repeated. He was a very loving, generous, kind, funny guy. He'd love to tease. He was the life of the party. he said that sports was what prevented him from becoming a juvenile delinquent because he was the black sheep. And he became a baseball player. I think you know this part of the story. He was a semi-pros and he had an offer from the St. Louis Cardinals. I remember the picture with the red cardinal on the letter. And I read some of the articles about him. He was a southpaw, very good pitcher and slugger. And the analogy was to Babe Ruth. So he was really a very good player. And he had an accident in which he threw the ball very fast, hit a guy who died 3 days later. This was before the helmets that we have now. So that was essentially the end of his career. He could never throw the ball as fast again. He was so frail that that could happen again. So he got out of baseball and went into coaching women's softball. And it wasn't until teaching a course recently in psychology of career choice that I saw, you know, the connection between his coaching women and my getting into life coaching and executive coaching. He wanted me to be a baseball player, you know, and I was a klutz. And the good.
I can second that.
But I think the message he gave me was that I could do things that most women didn't do because most women at that time were not going into baseball. And when I went into psychology, as Leanne alluded to, there were very few women. There were like 3 in my class and I was the only one who finished. So there were very few women in psychology. During the World War II, he owned a bar where he listened to people's stories. And, well, I could tell you a lot about that, about the soldiers and so on. But then after the war, he went into real estate. And people would come to sell their house. And why are they selling their house? They're getting a divorce, that's why. So they would come and talk with my dad. And he'd close the door, and I was outside as a receptionist. And then they would leave, and then they would come back again, and he would talk with them. And then they would come again, and then they weren't getting a divorce. And they weren't selling their house. And so he had a reputation in the community where people came with all their problems. It wasn't just about selling the house or what insurance to get. They just came to him for advice. And when he died, people lined the streets because he was such a well-loved man. Very generous, giving. My mother would send him to collect rent, you know. And she'd come back and she'd say, "You get the rent?" And he'd said, "Well, no. They couldn't afford to get food, so I bought them food." That just speaks to who he was as a person. And I would say in terms of my career, the main thing, the message was that I could do anything. My gender didn't need to hold me back. My mother was Czechoslovakian, very much an introvert, unlike my dad. Her great love was reading. She read out the library. She would be waiting for the library to get her a new book, so that she could have something else to read. She taught me a great love of learning and curiosity. I'd say that she originally wanted me to be a concert pianist. I got the piano lessons that she always wanted. And I need some water. Is that wine or water, Lynn?
Doesn't matter, Gail. No, it's water.
It is water, thanks. So she wanted me to be a concert pianist, but then Sputnik happened. Some of you old enough to remember Sputnik? And so they really wanted people to go into science and engineering. And so my mother really pushed me. I didn't want to be an engineer, but science really appealed to me. And I got a subscription to Sky and Telescope. I wanted to be the first woman astronaut. And I started college in math and physics. Math was very easy for me, really easy. Now, what else do I want to...
Growing up in a suburb in the South in the 50s and 60s.
Segregated, completely segregated. There were no blacks allowed to buy property. And where in Highland Springs, there were, couldn't go to school there. There were rules, and I remember thinking, and this probably got my interest in social psychology, there were rules of how you behaved, you know, what we would call norms now. I just said, there are rules, there have got to be other rules. You know, this can't be the only way you live. There must be other rules. And that, I think that started my interest in breaking out of where I came from, very contained community.
So tell us about Gail, the student in grade school and high school.
I was the perfect student. I was what any teacher would envy. I did my homework. I read the stuff ahead of time. I studied. You know, it was rare, I guess. But I was a really very good student. I got very good grades. I was the top of my class in my high school, college, and graduate school. So I was very, very studious, and I loved learning. I would say the one negative was that I got money for every A that I got. And that really encouraged me. Maggie, I didn't see you before. Encouraged me to do well academically. But the negative side was I figured out what the teachers wanted, and I gave it to them. I was really good at that, but I didn't learn what I wanted to learn. So I'm sure the students have all heard me say, don't do what I did. Figure out, when you take a course and there are requirements, how can it serve you? What do you want to learn from this versus trying to figure out what's going to get you an A, which was too much a part of my... I would say high school and college.
Did you receive any awards in high school?
I wanted to tell you first about my high school guidance counselor, because this was an important thing for me. So I had been doing really good in my grades, right? And my senior year, I took some tests. It was a standardized test, and I didn't do well on. Especially, I did not do well on alphabetizing. You know, that is a really important skill to have. Filing, you really need to alphabetize. I did very bad on it. So the the guidance counselor called me in, and my parents, and she said, you should not go to college. You are what we call an overachiever. You study real hard. You're not that bright. You just study hard. And you should not go to college. And if you do go to college, plan to never get above a C. If you decide to go to college. This is the origin of the imposter feelings, you can see, right? So But my response to her was, I'm going to college, and I'm never going to get a C. I'm going to never get below a B, which I did too. But it made an impact on me and on my parents. Shortly after that, I took another test, which was an achievement test. I don't know what that standardized test was, but I took an achievement test, and based on that, I got a scholarship to go to West Hampton. That's why I went to West Hampton. I really wanted to go to William and Mary, which Matt went to, but I didn't get to go. But it was such a great scholarship based on the test I'd taken that I couldn't. My parents couldn't turn it down. So,
what were you like in your college years?
My college years, I was a very serious student. Remember, I had to prove that guidance counsel wrong. And I think the other thing is, I really became in touch with my sexuality, and it scared the shit out of me, you know?
This is being recorded, Gail.
Well, you told me I could say anything in front of Laura. Well, I mean, I started dating, and I thought, you know, you could get pregnant, Gail, you know, this is not good. So it scared me. And I threw myself into my studies. And that was a good thing. It didn't last through graduate school. It didn't last.
We're all happy to hear that. So you were...
But there's one other thing I want to tell you about my high school years. I was very involved in extracurricular activities. And one of the things is I was elected to be like president of the Y Teens. And I had really... So I went to this very white high school. And I had asked my mother, why do the whites sit on the front of the bus and the black sits on the back? And my mother, who was a little OCD, had looked at microscopes and seen germs. So here was her story to me. Black is dirty. Dirty is germs. If you sit next to a black person, you're going to get sick. That's what she told me, okay? So here, and I am the rebel. So I go to Richmond, where I meet young black women and a black woman organizing, and I like them. I was like, shit, you know. It shook me up. So I decided that I would try to sit on the back of the bus. Now, I was scared, because I was afraid I was going to get sick and my mother would know what I'd been doing, right? Sitting on the back of the bus. But I did it. Everybody was upset. But the world didn't come to an end and I didn't get sick. And I tried it again and I didn't get sick. Everybody was so uncomfortable, I didn't do it anymore. But I had learned to challenge ideas, to think for myself, that my mother didn't have all the answers. And I'm sure it also got me interested in social psychology and prejudice, and my mentor in social psychology was very active in the civil rights movement. So
what led you away from being an astronaut and into psychology?
Oh, okay. Well, two things. I would say one summer, math was very easy for me, so I was majoring in math and minoring in physics, and I worked for the IRS, and I decided, oh my God, you know, I could spend all my time just with papers and numbers, and that didn't look like fun to me. And then I took my first psychology course, and like many people, it was intro to psych, right, that started you, and I had a professor who Matt later had as a professor at William & Mary, Bob Johnson, who I love. Matt didn't have the same thing, but he was my mentor. He taught me intro, he got me to think, and that did it. It was the combination of science and people, the science from my mom, the people person that my dad was.
So were you involved in Psy-Chi in college?
I was inducted, and I came to the ceremony. We had a banquet always and a speaker. And we had the tradition of a book that was geared toward the student who was getting the award, and it was always based on service. I knew nothing about it, and I'd gotten there early, and I overheard the professors talking about it. It's a secret, she doesn't know. And then I found out later that I was a recipient. So that would make it was such an important award to me, and it was signed by all the faculty. I still have the book, so.
And what was the book?
It was a book on personality, because at that time I was very interested in theories of personality.
So what made you decide to go on to graduate school in psychology and the particular program you chose?
Well, when I when I graduated, I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. I'd never had a career course or even thought about careers in psychology. That's why when I became chair, I introduced two courses on careers, because I didn't want the students to graduate without ever being aware of what they could do or being confident that they knew something that somebody would value. I just didn't know. And so I decided to go to graduate school. That's an easy choice if you're a good student. And my faculty members told me they suggested where to apply, and one was Kentucky. And Kentucky gave me an incredible scholarship. And it was in teaching, and I had to be a teaching assistant. And I said, I'm not interested in teaching. I don't ever want to be a teacher. I want to be a clinician. I shouldn't take this. And my faculty said, this is an incredible scholarship. It paid for my tuition, my room and board. It paid for everything for 5 years. And I had $5,000 in the bank every year because I just couldn't spend all the money they gave me. And so they were right. I shouldn't have turned it down. But I did have to teach the lab for Intro to Psych. That was what I had to do to start out. And it was okay, but that's not really what got me into teaching. What happened is I got there, and the first pro seminar was like complete, the first course was completely beyond me. I'd never heard of it. It was something called verbal learning. I'd never had a course in verbal learning, and the undergraduates who had gone on there, they had all had it. So anyway, I said to myself, I do not belong here. Remember the guidance counselor? I'm really not that bright. I got in. I don't know how I got in, but I got in. I didn't do that well on the GREs. And I said, I'm going to just work as hard as I can. And if I don't make it through this first test, then it's obvious I need to go home. You know, I don't belong here, and I'm just going to go home. But I'm going to work real hard, you know, to see. So the test results came. We had to go up to the instructor. He didn't have the papers with him. You know, we had to go. He had their grades in his grade book. We had to go up and get it. And I had studied with this other friend, Pat, and I heard Pat get an A-. And in graduate school, a C is failing, right? So I was prepared. So I go up to hear my grade. It's C. So I go away, and I say, congratulations to Pat, and she says, congratulations to you. And it turned out I had gotten an A, but I had heard a C, because in my mind, I was prepared to leave graduate school. I didn't belong here. I heard a C, and I had to go and verify that I'd gotten an A. But again, you see the imposter stuff coming out.
So that program at Kentucky was a social program or a social clinical program?
Now, here's what happened. I wanted to be a clinician, but I was in this program to be a teacher and a researcher, right? Wait a minute. I have to tell you something else first. The guy I was dating, when he found out I got the top grade on the first test, he didn't even keep the date. And then people began to like steal my test because I kept setting the curve on all the exams. And the other thing is I would go each time, I'm afraid I'm going to fail. This time I'm going to fail. And my colleagues got really upset with me. You know, like, Gail, you keep setting the bar. You keep, you know, setting the curve on all the tests. And you're afraid you're going to fail? They were mad. So I learned to shut up. It didn't stop me, but I shut up about it. And then the other thing I did was that I decided that if I could teach them so they knew as much as I did, then they wouldn't be mad, right? They wouldn't be upset with me. So I learned the material, and I would try to think what questions would they ask so I could really explain it well, and that's how I got into teaching. I started teaching my fellow students so they would know as much as I did. Then I wanted to go into clinical, but there was this guy who was head of the clinical program. I took all the clinical courses I could take, but I had to get through this one guy. And my best friend Pauline and my other friend Connie were both married at the time, and they said, Gail, you're not married, you're single. You're going to have even more trouble getting through this guy, who was not physically abusive, but emotionally and psychologically abusive to women. And I did do my master's thesis with him, got it published in the Journal of Experimental, very good thesis. But I kept getting these warnings, and he got worse, and I finally said, I just can't do it. So I changed to social, even though I had taken all the clinical courses, I switched to social, and it was Al Lott and Bernice Lott who were very influential social psychologists, very much activists, and they were my mentors.
So what was that master's thesis on, do you remember?
Verbal operant conditioning.
How unlike you.
But it was one of these, such a controlled study, you know, I had heard about the Rosenthal effect, so I made sure that all I wouldn't get any experimenter bias. I mean, it was really a very well-designed study, but it has nothing to do with the real world because it's so, you know, if you reduce the error variance so much, you know, you can show the effect of almost anything, so. Yeah, right.
And your doctoral dissertation, what was that on?
That was on social facilitation, because I was in social psychology by then.
Well, I remember having you in a very wild class, The Psychology of Women, in 1976. Mm-hmm. And by that time, you were a strong feminist. So something happened between those the mid-60s and the mid-70s to really change you. What was that?
Well, my dear friend Pauline gave me a book to read. It was called The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir. I bet you know the book. Many of you know the book. And it was like radical shift in my, just a radical change in how I looked at the world completely. And then Al and Bernice were great feminists. Bernice has written a lot in feminism, and she was a wonderful role model, and their relationship was a wonderful one. And when they left Kentucky, they followed her career instead of Al's career. And then the other thing that happened to me is when I went, I had a job at University of Massachusetts, Boston. And when I got the job, there were two other women in the department, and they came up to me and said, Gail, they've chosen you for this position. You are more qualified than the guy they hired last year. He was hired as an instructor. He's making X. You have to make X plus Y, You know, you can't, they really helped me negotiate my salary, in other words. And it kept going up, you know, to the head of the department and to the president. And I just kept repeating, well, the women told me that. And he said, well, we don't have an X plus Y. We're going to have to give you X plus Y plus Z. I said, okay, I can handle that. So I got a great salary. And the women, the three women in the faculty were really supportive of each other. We all had daughters. We passed, you know, clothing down. And we got very active. One of the things we did is we took control of the switchboard of the university. I don't know if you even know what a switchboard is anymore, but you know, it's like taking control of all the emails and everything that goes through the university. So if you called, you got, this is Dr. Matthews from the psychology department. The women have taken control of the university, and we were protesting equal pay for women's sports, you know, giving women equal access to sports and money funding it. So.
Sounds fun.
It was fun. That taking over was a lot of fun.
So what about your postdoc after you left graduate school?
Well, because my degree was in social, I wanted to get my clinical training. And there was a possibility of my coming to UC Berkeley and doing my postdoc at Palo Alto VA. But Berkeley is really more of a research than a clinical institution. So I kind of ruled them out. The other possibility we looked into was University of Michigan. They, too, were more research, and they wanted me to do community psychology, and I really wanted clinical. So I wound up at the University of Cincinnati and doing my postdoc at the VA there and at the University of Cincinnati to get the additional clinical work. And Len Goodstein, who was head of the department then, became my mentor. He later became president of APA. So I had wonderful mentors.
And I know you had a number of different jobs before making your way out to California in 76. And one of them I've heard about is that you worked for IBM for a while.
Oh, that was, I worked for IBM when I was in graduate school. I made a little extra money in addition to that money. I worked for IBM doing human factors. I don't know whether, Barbara, you knew that, but we were working on the type, changing the type, the keyboard, which is now the modern keyboard. We work with this electric typewriter.
And then you were at Mount St. Joseph.
After I finished my postdoc, and by that time I was married, and I went to Mount St. Joseph's as head of their counseling center, like our counseling center here, and I was teaching. Then I got pregnant, and Larry got a great offer to go to Boston and to Cambridge with the Family Service Agency. He was a medical social worker. And we moved there. Then from there, after Holly was about 6 months old, I got the job at Boston, UMass Boston. And then Larry, then we went to New Jersey, right? He got a job as head of a Family Service Agency in New Jersey, and I taught at C.W. Post University in Long Island, commuted through the Cross Bronx Expressway at 5 in the morning during the energy. Remember, the fuel was a problem. You had to wait in line for gas. That was a sabbatical replacement position, and then I went to Uppsala College in New Jersey, where I was director of career counseling and teaching.
So how did you end up here at Dominican?
Well, Larry got another offer. We could have either stayed, it could have been in New York, or it could have been in Washington, D.C., and I had lived in Virginia close to Washington, so I didn't particularly want to go back there. And both of us had been in San Francisco, and we both love San Francisco, so it was an easy choice to come to San Francisco. So, you know, I had all this training and resumes and cover letters and all that, so I knew to just send them to any college in the area. And Dominican, I thought, was probably all boys. Dominican just sounded masculine to me. So I thought it was going to be, I said, they're never going to hire me. They probably, you know, want a man. And Bob Shoecraft, who was head of the department, called me. The first, we just moved in and we just had the phone connected. And it wasn't connected 5 minutes and Bob is calling me. And it was in July. And, I, you know, in the East Coast, believe me, you had your faculty nailed down. And I thought, oh, this is California. They do it at the last minute, you know. He interviewed me, and I think what impressed him was that I liked Roger Brown. For those of social psychology know Roger Brown's famous book in social psychology, I think that's what got me the job. And I said, well, I don't want to just teach one course. I was in Orinda, so I wound up teaching two courses in the fall and two in the spring. And then what I did not know was that Dominican was going through, the psychology department was going through their review, and they had an outside team come, and they were not happy with the psych department. And Bob and the other main faculty at the time had their degree in theology, so a lot of traditional psychology courses were missing. Bob developed some great courses in theories of personality and so on. But so over the summer, well, at the end of my spring semester, Bob recommended me to be full-time. And so that happened. Then over the summer, the dean called me and asked me to chair the department. So I was very nervous, you know, how was Bob going to react to this? And I think he handled it very well. And it was mainly because they wanted to deal with accreditation. They wanted a psychologist as the head of the department. Bruce Willits, the other person, had much more difficulty. He was very, very threatened. And I left my first meeting with them crying. It was just a very, very bad experience.
So what was Dominican like overall 40 years ago?
Well, I would say there were many more nuns on campus, many more sisters, you know, and you knew them. I really miss that. They're not as, I really got to know them. I was a little intimidated by Sister Samuel, but but the other sisters, I really, really enjoy them, and we don't see as many of them on campus now. The students were more like I was as a student. You know, I think maybe they didn't have to work like our current students have to work full time. You know, they're working full time, they're going to school. And at that time, they read their assignments ahead of time. They came to class prepared. And I remember teaching, and I think you were in the class, child development. You and my child? Yeah. I'm teaching child development. So I'm teaching them what I know and giving them little anecdotes about my daughter. And then I think Terry Hamilton Gayheart said, well, what are you reading? Well, we want to read that. So I was reading Bettelheim, and so the students voted they wanted to read it. It was like, oh, my goodness.
Something of enchantment, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, uh-huh. The uses of enchantment. Mm-hmm. So that's, I would say, a big difference now. And
what sisters were you close to?
Sister Carol, Sister Joanne. I would say, and Sister Aquinas.
A very special conversation with Sister Aquinas about whether or not you could talk about abortion in the classroom.
Oh, okay, you remember. Okay, so that's an interesting, she remembers the story. So I'm going to teach psychology of women, and Sister Aquinas says, are you going to talk about abortion in that class? And I said, well, Probably. So that was the end. Then she called me in again. Gail, are you going to present both sides of the abortion issue? I said, well, of course. I present both sides of everything. So that was the end of that. And then she called me in again. What about if you have a priest come in and talk? I said, okay, I'll take Father Jude. Now, Father Jude was very, do you remember Father Jude? Oh, he was a great dancer, too. So I said, yeah, I'll have Father Jude come. She said, what about having this other priest? I said, I've changed my mind. I don't think we're going to have a priest come in the class. It was a very, do you remember the discussion about abortion? It was really emotionally charged.
Mm-hmm. It was just a few years after Roe versus Wade.
Right, right. And also, then later, I wanted to teach a sexuality class. So I go to Sister Aquinas. She said, well, what about teaching it with Father Jude? The course was called Christian Sexuality.
Boring.
Well, and you can imagine all the faculty were calling, well, Gail, how is Christian sexuality different than sexuality? But I got to teach the course. The next time, he didn't teach it with me, and it was called human sexuality, not Christian sexuality.
I know you've taught tons of courses over your career here. Any particular favorites for you in terms of topics?
Well, I love teaching psychology of women. I also love the career classes. You know, they were my babies because I really had a mission that I wanted my students to get some sense of they know what their talents are and they know how they can be used. That was really important to me. And then I love field placement because you get to see in one semester the incredible growth and confidence when the students, you know, put themselves into it.
So why don't we shift gears a little bit and talk about Gail as a researcher. You've participated in some pretty major research studies over the years, and I think anyone who has you as a teacher knows about the imposter phenomenon, and you've already alluded to it tonight. So how did you get into doing that research?
Well, my best friend in graduate school was Pauline Clance. Pauline and I, you know, Pauline was in my wedding, or one of my bridesmaids, her husband was the minister, Unitarian minister who married us. So Pauline and I, you know, went different ways, and she went to Oberlin to teach at Oberlin. And they, at Oberlin, when you do a thesis, a senior thesis, not everybody is required, you're invited to do a senior thesis. So what she found was that women were not, they were being invited, but they weren't accepting. They weren't doing it. And when she talked with them, she said, well, what they were saying was, now they're going to find out that I'm not that bright. You know, I've made it so far through these years, but now with this more challenging thing, they're going to find out. And I'm going to be exposed as an imposter. That was the sort of the gist of it. And so Pauline wrote to me. She said, Gail, you're good at research. I want you to review my article before I send it in. And I'm reading it and critique, you know, giving her feedback. But I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is what I went through when I was in graduate school. I went through that many times. And so I said, Pauline, I want to do some research, too, on this. And so I remember telling Bob Shoecraft about it. And Bob said, you know, it's not men experience this, too. It's not just women who experience it, which Pauline was thinking. It was just women. And then he also gave me another hypothesis. He said, maybe people in academia experience it more because you get, you know, maybe you're not that confident in what you know, and so you have to get a new crop of students every year to convince you you know something. So I decided what I would do is to see if the imposter phenomenon occurred in different careers, or whether it was more some careers that were more likely. And so I used the strong, you know, Strong Campbell characterizes occupations in six different areas, artistic, scientific, et cetera. So I picked people in occupations from all the six areas and interviewed them and asked them to tell me about their successes. And then the question that I followed up with, to what do you attribute that success? And I can remember one famous psychologist I interviewed. She said, well, what about your first book? Well, it was the right timing. What about your second book? Well, it was just chance. And she suddenly realized about on the fourth success that she was not taking credit for any of her successes. She was attributing them all to chance. So basically what I found is there were no gender differences, no differences between occupations, and about 70% of the people I interviewed experienced it at some time in their life, not always. Some people had it more pronounced, and that 70% figure has been replicated in a couple of other studies. So I was talking to Pauline. I said, why don't we do a symposium on this? You know, I had done the research. She had done one. We knew another therapist, two other people. So I organized a symposium that was held at an APA conference in Toronto. And what we didn't know is there was a reporter from the New York Times in the audience. So he called Pauline and I after the symposium, and he asked these very astute questions. It's like, this guy must know, he must have taken some psychology courses. You know, he's really asking very, very complex questions. Well, it turned out he had gotten his degree in clinical psychology from Harvard. His name was Daniel Goleman, and he later wrote Emotional Intelligence, but I didn't know who I was being interviewed by. But what happened is, since it got into the New York Times, then it got in all into the media, and I got to be on television and in Time magazine and all of that, my 15 minutes of fame.
Well, you've had a second 15 minutes of fame with your most recent research, and it's been quoted everywhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably like 30 different publications, and I bet you a lot of people don't know about that recent research. So why don't you talk about your goals research?
Okay. I started off doing New Year's resolutions with Dominican students, but then we had a speaker at graduation, Millie Filford Hughes. She's an astronaut. So I paid attention to the fact she was a woman astronaut. And she quoted some study that had shown that if you write down your goals, you're like 40% more likely to achieve them. She quoted something. So that really interested me. So I contacted her, and she said, well, I got this from some book I read. And then I contacted the book author. Well, he had gotten it from, I think, Tony Robbins, you know. So, long story short, and I can remember Bill helped me with this. Remember you found an article about, it's never been done. The research was never done. It was supposedly done at Harvard or Yale. It was never done. And so I decided to find out whether it was true. So I had people, I was interested in business people because of the study, the quote study that was never done was supposedly done on Harvard Business School graduates. So I went to all kinds of business organizations to recruit participants. It was all done by email. I had five groups. One group was to ask to just think about a goal. And then they were asked to how important it was and a lot of other questions. The second group was asked to write down their goal, type it in on the email. The third group was asked to write it down and then come up with some plans for how you would accomplish a goal. That was number four. The fourth group wrote it down, came up with plans, and shared their goal and their plans with a supportive friend. And then the fifth group did all of that, plus once a week they had to send progress reports to the friends. So I sent them little emails once a week to remind them. It was a little scale, rate your progress, how are you doing, and what do you need to do next? And then they were to send that email to their supportive friend to be accountable to them. And when I first looked at the results, and that's what I reported when I did my sabbatical report, I forgot to look at the manipulation of the independent variable, because all of that was done by instruction, right? They were asked to do all these things, but did they do it or not? That's another question. So the manipulations were effective, but so many participants had to be omitted from the final data because they didn't follow the instructions, so they weren't really in the group I assigned them to. So when I redid the data, there were still two important findings. If you wrote down your goal, you're much more likely to accomplish your goal than if you just think about it. So that was supported. The other thing was that the fifth group that was accountable to their supportive friend and wrote it down and all of that, they did better than any other group, significantly better than any of the groups. So accountability would be the main ingredient that fifth group had, but they had the other steps as well. So now this is quoted, and I get, you know, every year around New Year's resolution time, I get, you know, the media contacts.
Well, I know you got interested in that study, too, because you had been a clinical psychologist in practice for probably over 20 years by the time that you did that research, and then you became interested in coaching.
Yeah.
And it was through coaching and goal setting that you were really interested in how to help people achieve goals.
And the other thing is positive psychology really made a big impact on me. When Marty Seligman said, you know, for those of you who are psychologists may know, he really said that psychology needs to go on a different trajectory. Instead of taking care of mentally, you know, dealing with mental illness, we want to take people who have a good life and help them have a great life. And I think that little, you know, course correction sort of is going to play out in the future of psychology. You know, so that we'll not only have a classification of mental illness, we have a classification of human strengths, and I think that's a big shift in psychology. I'm anticipating one of your other questions.
Which one was that? What do you believe is the most valuable aspect of psychology today? I bet you that's it.
I think neuroscience and positive psychology are the two biggest trends, and that's where we need to go. That's what I think. And I'm just happy to be a part of positive psychology. I don't have the wherewithal to do the neuroscience, but.
So next year will be your final year in phased retirement. What are you hoping to do? What are your goals for retirement? And how can I help you meet them?
I want to travel. And I want to become a student again. I want to take classes. I want to take art history, astronomy. I'm still interested in astronomy and anthropology. And I want to develop maybe a comparative religion. And I want to develop a more spiritual practice in my life.
That's great. Well, thank you, Gail.
Oh, you're welcome.
I want to open up to questions from the audience, too. And we've been talking for about an
Bill's
hour.
Bill's got a bad grin on his face.
I don't have a question. I just want to use the restroom. send them all to us.
Great, Bill. We'll, I love it.
We'll make sure she does that.
Every month.
Do you need a microphone to go to someone if they're asking a question? Because this is being podcast. Okay, so here comes the microphone. Maggie
I think, had a question, yeah.
I think it needs to be recorded for the radio.
Okay. Gail, what advice do you have for young psychologists in training or just entering the field?
I would say learn as much as you can. You know, just take all the extra credit workshops and continuing education. I know what made me go into get a PhD in psychology as opposed to an MFT is I just wanted to be prepared for anybody could walk into my door, and I wanted to know I was best prepared as I could be. So I would just say, you know, keep learning.
Anything else?
Thank you. I wanted to thank you, Gail, for all of those places in your life that you really pushed through the thinking that said you shouldn't do it, and you did it. Because that's a tremendous amount of work. And I loved hearing your story that goes all the way back to the incredible support you got from your father. And it's palpable, your love for your father and your mother. It was different. But, you know, in working with people, I'm very fascinated by the incredible subtleties of good therapy. And it's about the relationship. And it's about a connection that takes place and in a very interesting, very ethereal kind of realm. And not that I didn't love Bob Shucraft's theory of personality and the 12 books I had to carry around in my car along with my teenager's soccer balls. But it's that I think imparted on me and my life and my career now that you absorbed from your father, that you believed in, and you passed that belief on to me that I could do it, because I didn't come into Dominican with a lot of academic confidence. And it was this experience here, and I mean, I just want to cry. I mean, you really have made a difference in my life. And that career class, I mean, I was all the way to my senior year, I think, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was helping me to focus and to think about what I wanted to do. But also, it was that unbelievable heart that you bring to what you've done in your life that made that difference to me to really keep going and to go to graduate school and to believe in myself. So I just want to thank you, because that had to be really, really hard to go to that back of the bus and to believe in having that guidance counselor tell you that those things, that you rose above that. And I had to rise above a lot too. And I want to thank you, because I'm here tonight. And I'm really glad I'm here. And I'm really here because you had a lot to do with it.
I knew we'd need the Kleenex.
Oh, we need them.
You can use this one.
Gail, I'm going to stand up because I'm short. I want to thank you, too. I feel the same way, and I know my triumvirate feels the same way. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you, and we wouldn't be doing the good work we're doing if it wasn't for you. And I'm curious what you're reading now.
What am I reading now?
Well, I just got through reading Educated. Have you read that book? It's a wonderful book about someone who was supposedly homeschooled, who really rose from this.
What? Okay.
That's the Kleenex.
Okay. It's a really great book.
Well, Gail, I just wanted to thank you for hiring me
for my first full-time position here, but I really think that the psych department, you know, you're creating the psych department and having the atmosphere, the nurturing kind of, the fun and nurturing kind of atmosphere that we've had all these years is really a testament to you. And after your 22 years as chair, it took Leanne and me both to fill your shoes and co-chair the department. So I think, I hope we've carried that tradition on with our newer faculty members, but we owe you a lot for, you know, starting that all.
Well, Matt, I thank you, because I feel that way too. I feel that I created an atmosphere of support and fun.
Despite the fact that you had me teach three sections of director research,
but
yeah, per semester, but it was otherwise great. So thank you.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. You are one of the rare people that have an extreme intellect, but you have a huge heart, and that's rare to find in people. And you have been an inspiration to me since the day I met you. And that was in 1987, I think. Yeah.
And I remember you well.
I know you too.
In statistics and research methods.
Yes, we had a big argument.
And she was like...
I know. And I want to thank you for giving me my wings and the ability to accept a doctorate program and finish and become a psychologist, because honestly, you're the person who pushed me in that direction. Thank you.
I never knew the background, as I don't think most of us did, about the imposter. And I always thought it was the wrong direction for you, because you were such an optimist before there was anything about optimistic psychology. I was in a whole different world in New York City when I spoke to you on the telephone. You gave me the confidence. I was already moving. I knew where I was going to go. Dominican, and that hee-haw laugh, and so I was terrified, and you've taken so many of us who felt we were imposters and couldn't do it, and just rose, took the bar and put it so high, because you knew we could jump, and just pushed us over. I never had a question about what I was going to do as my next step after research methods with you and reading with Bob Shoecraft theory for a summer. And I knew what I was going to do because I was told what to do by you and Bob to be a psychologist. Thank you.
Some of us might remember where we were on 9/11. Yes. I actually was in class with you, Gail.
You're kidding.
I was. And I'll never forget, because it was such an incredible experience. That morning, I was really terrified, feeling like, well, life will never be the same, all my hopes and dreams, and now I'm in this program, and it just, the world is just never gonna be the same. I'm not gonna go to where I wanna go. But I came to class, and you went totally into being a clinical psychologist. You were just opening it up to everybody, and people were sharing what they experienced. And I remember one student, he came from a military family, which of course informed his experience in a very different way than my experience as this Marin liberal. And I was just in there listening and just being able to just be there and taking it all in and somehow going on. So thank you for you just, I mean, you were always so large and you made so much space for everything and everybody. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you for reminding me of that, Donna.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a glorious round of applause for a wonderful woman.
It's over.